Welcome to the Brown Riot podcast. This podcast is all about what it takes to be successful in advertising when you're from a different ethnic, cultural, or socio-economic background to the majority. I'm going to be talking to some awesome creative leaders, as well as a bunch of brilliant planners, MDs, and CEOs, getting their viewpoints and experiences about getting in and achieving success in the industry. But whether your skin happens to be brown, black, yellow, pink, green, or any shade in between, these chats are filled with a load of insight and inspiration around creativity that I believe can lead us to a better industry doing better work. Our guest today was born in South Africa. He grew up in Clare Estate, a suburb in Durban reserved for people of Indian origin during apartheid. Back in those days, it was unusual for Indians to become anything other than doctors, lawyers, or teachers. However, with democracy in the 90s came opportunity, and he took his chances with advertising. Over the last 15 years, he's worked on three continents and won a shedload of awards in all the big shows, including a bunch of awards this year for the brilliantly disturbing and moving Stop the Horror project in support of voluntary assisted dying in Victoria. In his previous role, he jointly led the creative department at Cummins & Partners Sydney and helped the agency break into the Cannes Top 20 Independent Agencies in the World, as well as winning Independent Agency of the Year titles at numerous publications. He's also worked at Wybin TBWA Sydney, the Jupiter Drawing Room, TBWA Hunt Lascaris, and Black River FC. He is the one, the only, Arvish Gordon. Welcome, Arvish.
Thank you very much. I'm going to get you to do all my introductions.
Yeah, I charge though, by the hour. Mate, I would love to start by, as I kind of always do with these podcasts, I'd love to start with just hearing a bit about your family background.
Well, I'm the baby in the family. I'm the one of three kids, and I'm the only boy, so I'm the favorite. I mean, hands down the favorite in the family. I grew up in a very close family. So Mandy van Merwe is my art director, and she's also my life partner. And she calls us the Brady Bunch because we're a really close-knit group of people. So there's my immediate family. But because I'm Indian, we have very large families. So it's not just the five of us. There's uncles and aunts and cousins and second cousins and 45th cousins. Mm-hmm. And I like to call it cousins by the dozens. That's the family makeup. And I suppose the thing about my family was that my mom and dad probably had the biggest impact on my upbringing, and they really shaped who I am. My mom and dad pretty much said to me at a very young age, do whatever you want to do as long as you're happy, which is quite a unique thing from an Indian perspective, especially from a South African Indian perspective.
They weren't pushing for lawyers and doctors?
Not at all. No, my dad said, find whatever you're happy and do that. He had one requirement. He said, just get an education. And he pretty much worked his socks off to get me into a university once I decided that I wanted to be in advertising. But I didn't come from a very affluent background. And so, it was the small family that helped me get into this university, with my dad working really hard and my mom contributing and helping as well. But then it was the larger family as well. So it was all the uncles and aunts. And in fact, my uncle and my cousin were the two people that basically helped me finish my university, because I needed, it was just too much and too expensive. And so it's, when I think about my family background, it's the reliance on a very large group of people, and an immense dependency on a very small group of people within that.
Yeah, and just to go back to the apartheid thing, how did that kind of influence and affect the upbringing as well? Because we talked about the Clare Estate being reserved for Indian community only during that period. Was it that strict? Was it literally just Indians in that area?
Well, it started off as just, it was an Indian-only area. Over time, there were blacks, so there were no whites in that area. Basically, the way it worked was, they called it the Group Areas Act, and the Group Areas Act was a law implemented in the 1950s, if I'm not mistaken. My history is terrible. But basically, the idea was that there'd be separate areas for different race groups. And it worked on a suburb-by-suburb basis. Obviously, the better areas went to white people, and the not-so-good areas went... the darker you were, the worse the area became. But you know, you talk about it and the effect of it. It was applied across everything, and you know, it was applied across industries. It was applied across schools that you could go to. So my primary school was an all Indian primary school, but then by the time I'd reached high school, we'd reached democracy and we'd had our first, you know, free elections, and so I went to a mixed race school in high school, which was quite an unusual.
How was that? Was that sort of liberating, or was it
Terrifying and liberating? Was, you know, it's an unusual experience when you realise that you are other, and when you know as a kid, when you're surrounded by, you know, a whole bunch of Indian and black kids, and I mean, I'm going to use the word coloured, but it's the term for mixed race people in South Africa. When you're surrounded by that in your primary school, you get used to a certain way, and then all of a sudden, you're exposed to a whole new race of people, and that's it's confronting.
And in terms of back in before the sort of integration of the different races and the elections and so on, in terms of racism, did you have experiences with racism, whether that's kind of direct and full on or the more subtle kind?
You know, I think I was very young and protected in my family. If there was any racism, it was always directed. I remember incidents with my dad where he would sometimes be pulled up at a traffic light by a cop, or nothing aggressive and nothing abusive, but it was always it was never aimed at me. I was probably too young to, you know, to be a threat, and I was really tiny, as you can see. I wasn't much bigger than I am now, and so I wasn't really a threat to anyone. But I think my first sort of experience with racism was probably in high school. And even then, by the time I'd reached sort of grade 11, that was sort of bred out of the system, because there were just so many people mixing together that there was no room for it and no space for it.
It's interesting what you say about your dad, though, with getting pulled over at the traffic light, because, you know, I've experienced quite a lot of racism in my life. It's kind of the more direct physical kind and the more subtle kind. And it's almost like the more subtle kind, the sort of the psychological kind of being pulled over by the cop for no reason or for a very spurious reason is almost worse than the other kind, because it's a bit more subtle and just makes you feel less than or makes you feel belittled in some way.
Yeah, I think if you look at the history of South Africa, there was a lot of it was a very threatening environment, and weirdly enough, you know, when you live there for a very long time, I lived there for the first 20 something years of my life, you get used to it, you get used to, you know, experiencing some level of tension, and you know, obviously that you become accustomed to it, and I think that that everywhere in the world experiences this. I think at the moment, if you look at the world at the moment, it's pretty prevalent all around the world. I think South Africa gets a bad rap because it institutionalized racism, but I think if you look at the world at the moment, there's a lot of tension that exists. You know, Australia, America, there's prime examples of this. It's when there's no reason for it, and when it's subtle and underhand, that it becomes threatening. When it's overt, you can almost do something about it. Mm. When there's no action, you're sort of on the line between reacting and, you know, just sitting back down again.
Mm. And sometimes thinking, am I just imagining this? Have I gone mad?
That's right.
Hey, just you mentioning your dad, that's fascinating, the idea of parents that would just say, you know, whatever makes you happy, particularly coming from that community. It made me contrast that with, I saw the Queen film recently. I don't know if you've seen that, Freddie Mercury film. He's from an Indian family, and he had a classic, very recognisable, sort of stereotypical Indian dad who was, you need to be studying, you need to be getting this job or that job. And he was obviously quite extravagant, and he wanted to be a rock star, which to this dad was complete anathema. And then, spoiler alert, but not too much of a spoiler alert, he wins him over at the end, and there's a beautiful scene at the end when the dad just really turns around and is really proud of him and sort of watches him on Live Aid. But you just get those scenes all the way through the film where the dad's just very sort of pissed off with him, his son being gay and flamboyant and all of those things. And I think that's a big thing in the Indian community, just those taciturn fathers who just want their sons to be, like you said, doctors, lawyers and stuff.
You know, I think I'm... I was very lucky. I think that so my mum and dad are both. So my dad actually was a teacher. He basically taught English and history at a high school level and at a high school level, and he was a very good teacher. And after I think 10 years, he decided, no, I'm actually going to go into law. And so he studied this thing and worked for 30 years as a lawyer thereafter. And I think that when you have that experience, when you decide, I don't want to do this, I want to do this, you can pass that opportunity on to people. You feel liberated enough in your own decisions to be able to pass it on. And so I think that's part of it. I also think that he recognized that we were about to have a change in the country, and that the restrictions that he faced and the limitations that he had were not necessarily applicable to my sisters and I.
Yeah, to the next generation.
The next generation. And, you know, my older sister is a lot older than me. She's 10 years older than me. And so I think she experienced it, you know, she experienced it more of that reality than I did. But I think by the time I was, you know, making a decision about what I wanted to do in my life, I think he looked at it and went, well, you can do what you want because you've got the opportunity.
It's a slightly different world. Hey, that is a really cool segue into the next topic, which is obviously want to get into advertising and creativity. So the world had opened up a bit. There'd been these elections. It was a bit freer and a bit more mixed. You've obviously come out of school or uni and you've got the opportunity to do whatever. Now, you've worked at some great agencies, some famous agencies in South Africa, TBWA, Hunt Lascaris and the Jupiter Drawing Room. What were those environments like? How did you get your start in those places, and what were the environments like? Were they quite mixed?
So I started at TBWA as in the pit, we called it. It was just
what's the pit?
It was a dangerous little place. It was where you went when you had just graduated. So basically 10 art directors put into a little pit. And you all set up with Max and
left to fight it out over briefs.
And well, left to fight it out to gain the attention of the teams that surrounded the pit. And they were all very senior teams. And you basically had to, you know, you'd help them out. You'd put their layouts together. You'd do a proactive work and try and get on the briefs that they were getting in on. But you were there to support them and basically learn from them in a very direct way.
Sounds like the Hunger Games of advertising.
It was like the Hunger Games of advertising, and an immense learning experience. I mean, very stressful, very long hours, and you know, all the typical things that, you know, people in advertising or starting out in advertising have to go through. But an amazing way of learning in that space. In terms of the actual makeup of the agency, you know, advertising was one of those industries that was really segregated and kept for white people. I mean, there was no reason to advertise to black people because it wasn't part of the makeup of the, you know, it wasn't part of the economy, it wasn't part of the system. So the advertising industry was largely before the 1980s, it was largely white. And after the election, obviously there was a transformation charter that was put in place, and there was an effort to try and change the makeup of advertising and the number of people that were black and brown and all other colors coming into the industry. But by the time I had started working, I mean, when I started there, there were probably three other black people in the entire creative department, and it was a big creative department. The thing about Hunt's, though, that was really quite spectacular. I mean, I didn't notice it then, but I notice it now. Is that it was probably the most gender diverse agency I've ever worked at in my life. And at a very senior level across all the departments, there were very senior women, including in the creative department. And I actually owe a lot to a couple of the women in that creative department, because I'd started out as an art director in the pit, but my goal was to become a writer. And I basically had to try and figure out how I was going to, you know, do that without, you know, ruining myself in the process. And there were three art directors, three CDs. They're very senior women: Jenny Glover, who's now in Toronto, Baby Lotta, and Camilla Herberstein, who were probably the three greatest mentors I could have had to start with, because they sort of took me under their wing and went, right, we're gonna help you get through this, without ever saying that, but basically gave me opportunities that I don't think I would have had they not been there. So despite the fact that it wasn't a very diverse group of people from a racial perspective, it was a very diverse group of people from a gender perspective, and it, you know, you could feel it, and it changed my career. So
that's interesting. We obviously had Ash Naidu on recently on the podcast, and he grew up in South Africa and started working first in South Africa as well. He told us some positive stories and also some stories about, for example, being called in to make up the numbers in meetings to kind of look good on in terms of quotas or for clients or whatever, which just sounded horrifying to me. Does that ring a bell with you? Was it
absolutely? In fact, it was. So I work, obviously, I mentioned Mandy earlier. So she's a white female. I'm an Indian male. We got all the numbers, all the boxes to be ticked in there. I think one of the experiences that we had was we came up with this campaign. We were presenting to for a pitch. It was a government pitch, and Mandy and I had worked on the entire campaign. And the time came to present, and they took me in, and they handed Mandy's work to a person more junior, because he was black, and they took him in. And it was because she was white and female, and it wasn't the right, you know, it wasn't the right thing to do. It didn't look right in the numbers game to take a white person into the meeting, to a government meeting. And, you know, it's the ugly side of a quota system, and it's an ugly side of you know, trying to represent yourself in a way that isn't exactly true, but it happens.
It's tricky, isn't it? It's a very difficult topic, the whole positive discrimination thing that we've been grappling with on the podcast over the last few weeks. I mean, I don't know if you caught this, but the situation in JWT London recently, JWT doesn't even exist anymore in the last couple of weeks, but there was a new creative director who came in and said she wanted to obliterate the agency's reputation as a Knightsbridge boys club, which led to 5 white straight senior creatives going to HR concerned, conversations being had. Allegedly that led to those 5 white straight males being made redundant. I mean, obviously we don't know the ins and outs of exactly what there is. There's probably some legalities going on, but it seemed quite unfair to me. I mean, obviously the right wing press, the Daily Mail, has jumped on that story, and you know, they're calling it diversity gone mad. I just want to be clear to everyone, I don't normally read the Daily Mail. I just want to say that now. That is not my normal reading. So that someone flick that
I was
to
gonna
me.
Judge
I'm not,
you,
I'm
but,
not a male reader, right. So please don't judge me. How do you feel about diversity? There's such a big focus on it, as per that creative director, but how do you get that balance right?
It's a tough question, right? Specifically, you know, let's talk about the JWT thing for a second, because I don't think I can answer this question specifically aimed at JWT, because I don't think I know the enough information. You can read all the articles, and I you know, when it came out, I sort of tried to flick through more than one news source to see if there was somewhere that had delved into it. There isn't actually enough information about what's happened there, and so I think it would be unfair of me to decide on the specific situation whether it's fair or unfair without filling the blanks with my own beliefs and my own prejudices, right? So I think that I'd rather talk about transformation and the transformation of businesses and organizations and how we approach that, you know, because for me, when I think about transformation, I don't think of it as a theoretical thing. I think that often we talk about transformation, but it gets lost in this sort of fuzzy theoretical space. And for me, it's an action. Transformation is an action, and it's change. And the faster transformation happens, the more likely there is that there's going to be some sort of unease and difficulty, because transformation over a very long time is just progress, and transformation over a very small time is it's revolution, right? It's two very different ways of approaching fixing the problem. I think it's very difficult if the time is right and if the time is ripe for transformation to tell people who may come from groups that have been discriminated against over generations or may have been overlooked for a very long period of time, I think it's unfair to tell them to wait and to be patient. And so I think that the only way we get transformation is to attack it and to make sure that at some point we don't tip over. that we don't swing the pendulum so far across that we end up being reverse discrimination. But I think that when you talk about transformation and you talk about it at a glacial pace or without conflict, I just don't think that exists. I just don't think that that's possible. I think that by its definition, by its nature, it change comes with problems and it comes with challenges and it comes with some unhappy people.
Mm. I mean, the culture and the zeitgeist does change, though. Maybe too slow for you, probably too slow for me. But I was just thinking the other day, because you mentioned the glacial pace, but I was just thinking the other day, an example of that transformation and the pace of it. I don't know if you're much of a football fan, but the Nick Hornby book, Fever Pitch, I don't know if you've ever read that book about his life as an Arsenal fan. He talks a lot about
I'm a Liverpool fan.
Social change. Yeah. And he talks about this wonderful moment when he kind of felt culture changing and the zeitgeist changing when he had a season ticket at Arsenal, he always has, and the guy that sat next to him, John mm-hmm. Barnes was playing, and every time John Barnes came on, the guy that sat next to him would be screaming and shouting at John Barnes, insulting him, saying, "You fucking black C-U-N-T," mm-hmm. and you know, saying this horrible stuff with this horrible racial insults. And then sort of the next season, the same guy sat there, and I don't know, maybe sort of society had imperceptibly changed, but this guy would still be shouting down at John Barnes, but it'd just be, "You fucking C-U-N-T," without the black thing. And Nick Hornby was like, just the fact that he's not putting the black thing in there, he's still insulting him, that felt to me like, okay, maybe that's just not acceptable anymore. Maybe it's a small thing, but maybe society is changing.
You know, if we allow ourselves to make bigger steps and take bigger leaps in the way we fix the problems that have probably been systemic for a very long time, the chances of actually rectifying the problem become a lot easier. There is a bigger danger, though. The danger is that you end up with you end up on the other side of discrimination. I think that also as an industry, let's go back, just to refer back to the industry, I think as an industry we maybe are approaching this idea of transformation in a slightly incorrect way, or maybe we haven't explored our, we're a creative industry, and yet our approach to transformation has been the way every other industry would transform. It's cut a few heads and put a few people in, and it feels like, as a creative industry, we haven't really considered that maybe there's other ways of fixing the problem. One of the things that I've often thought is that when people have, when people have something, they find it very difficult to not have. Whereas when people don't have something, they try and find solutions to get in and start to have. And I think maybe what we need to figure out as an industry is how do we make more space rather than how do we use the same space and fill it with new people. How do we expand the space and create a few more seats and squish a few more people in rather than cull what we have and replace it with something brand new and a new shade of person. Mm. And maybe that's the middle ground, I suppose, is to change the way we, find the new avenues that can be fulfilled by newer people and not necessarily cull at the expense of it.
You mean make it less of a zero-sum game where someone's got to lose in order for someone to gain? Yeah,
that's right.
Fair enough. I mean, the other thing is, I kind of, on this whole topic, I feel slightly conflicted because in my soul, I genuinely believe that thing about if you can't see it, you can't be it, or if you can't see it, it's hard to be it. I know when I was starting out, there weren't many people who looked like me, and I found it hard to ever imagine myself achieving the things I wanted to achieve. It just seemed that much harder. But at the same time, one of my mentors in London was a guy called Dave Trott, and he's an absolute legend, and among many lessons that he taught me, one of the things he said to me was that in creativity, in life really, but particularly in the creative industries, what's different about you? Your difference is your advantage. So the idea of being the only brown guy in the creative department, we got talking about that. He was like, mate, you've got such an advantage there. You know, you don't want loads of Indian and other brown people in the department because you're the only one, and that kind of gives you that absolute advantage. You want to work that for all you're worth. So I like being different, but I also at the same time want it to be more mixed up as well, because I hate it when I look around and in any department and it's all white males or all, you know, all anything, all one of any kind of person.
You know, somebody asked me once, I think I was doing a talk, and they asked me about, you know, the lack of brown people in advertising. And I said that it's very interesting what you said, because my opinion on creativity is that it's a perspective. It's a new perspective on something that exists. That's all creativity is, right? It's not the craft and all of those things are appendages to creativity, but absolute creativity, which is why it can be applied in almost any industry, in any field, in any profession, is just a new perspective on the same problem, and different backgrounds, different, you know, ideas of self, ideas of family, ideas of different heritages, different, you know, whatever it is, all these things that make up who we are as individuals, the more different they are, they add different perspectives. And so I 100% agree with that. The response, the question was around having so few brown people in advertising. And I laughed because I was like, I think it's excellent. I think as a human being, it's excellent, because they're killing it. They're rolling in that IT money. You know, they're making the, you know, they're hitting up these engineering firms, and they're killing it in medicine and lawyers. And, you know, the brown people are dominating in so many different fields and across so many different fields, and go for it. As an advertising person, I think we're missing ingredients. As an industry, we're missing ingredients in the way we speak, and in the way we talk to our audiences in a way that's actually unique, and also just a fresh perspective. You know, we don't have all the pieces. I think our biggest problem as an industry is that we don't know how to attract brown people to our business, because they don't need us. Brown people don't need to come to advertising, but we need brown people to do that. And the question is, how do we get people to look at us differently? Because at the moment, we're not even on the consideration set. We need to figure out or explain to people why they need us, because brown people, they're killing it everywhere else.
Yeah, so yeah, that's really interesting. I was reading something the other day, an interview with John Hegarty, and he said diversity is like rocket fuel for creativity. Avish, just to go on to that piece about attracting different kinds of people and brown people to advertising, you and your partner Mandy started a course to attract more ethnically diverse people to the industry, and I know that was around a pathway for a new generation of creatives to come from diverse places, and I know that's something you guys, both of you, feel really passionate about. Can you tell us a bit about that?
So yeah, it was a project called we called it Project Represent, and it was a workshop that we held in Melbourne and Sydney, and basically aimed at well, we had the youngest person we had there was 13 years old, so we had a high school kid.
Good to start young, yeah. Good to definitely.
He arrived. He took 3 hours. He and his friend took 3 hours to get to the session. They travelled, you know, on a Saturday morning, you know, travelled the hard yards, and basically got there for the actual workshop. And we had people who were, you know, master's students who were trying to figure out exactly what this industry is all about. And the purpose of the workshop was basically just a crash course in what we do in advertising, because I think the biggest problem that we have is people just don't know what we do. My mum still doesn't really understand. She understands now, but that's, you know, it's a recent development. But, you know, people just don't know. Sometimes even the people we work with don't know what we do. You know, there's a mystery around this idea of creativity and marketing, and so the workshop was about introducing this idea of what marketing is and introducing the idea of advertising to people who've never experienced it and would not even be considering what to, you know, how to use it. And it was a really interesting workshop, and it was you know, I feel like it's just the beginning. It's not enough to just do you know, a couple of workshops. We did a few workshops, and you know, there were maybe 45 to 50 people in total, maybe a bit more, a bit less. But it was just not enough. Like you can't do this as a one-off thing. I think we need to figure out as an industry how we speak to groups of people from very different backgrounds, change their perception. And I actually think we need to change people's perceptions at a very young age. I think by the time you're in third year university, you've got a very clear idea of where you're heading, and we're trying to move you from a very long distance. Whereas when you're still deciding what you want to do, and we present advertising in its truest form and its best form, which is problem solving, and every day is a challenge, and every day is an opportunity to use creativity, and we can help build the economy, and you present advertising in its most positive light to people who are making their decision about, you know, at a very early age about what they want to do, and then you can maybe start to make a difference in the long run. And so that's what Project Represent was about. It was just about trying to catch people and just enlighten them about what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's awesome and inspiring. We've talked a little bit about it before, and hopefully we can do more with that. And I'd love to get involved in that more. But I also think one of the biggest things that you've not talked about there for me is just the idea of these kids from different backgrounds seeing you there, having someone as a figurehead, you know, an inspiration that's in the business that's doing it, that can talk from experience. I mentioned when I was starting out, there weren't really many people that I could look up to. I worked, one of my first jobs, I worked for a guy called George Betsis, who was, and still is really, one of my heroes. He was not from an Indian background or a Bangladeshi background like me, but he was a working class Greek guy. And it's just very, very different in the industry at that time, an industry that was really full of middle class Caucasian, North Shore, you know, well-to-do people, and this kind of working class Greek guy had come in and smashed it and done really, really well, set up his own agency, hired me. And that guy was, he taught me so much, but also just inspired me. So I think for the Project Represent, just for those kids to see you doing it and saying it can be done, it can't be underestimated how important that is.
You know, It is seeing people like you, seeing people like me, seeing people like Ash, and you know, this podcast is an excellent example of what needs to happen. We need to make people realize that there is actually a pathway to success. There is actually a way to, well, not even to success, but there's a pathway in this career to achieve something, and it's not just hidden in the backgrounds. I think, you know, when you look at all other industries, we celebrate the diversity across it happens organically across different fields, but in advertising we sort of hide away the personalities of our industry. It's a very unique sort of problem that we have. You talk about seeing it to be it. The first person that basically gave Mandy and I a job was Amit Tilley, a very, very incredible human being from South Africa, and a CD there. And Mandy and I had been, you know, we'd been stalking him for, I mean, just months at a time, sending him flowers and balloons, and you know, it was just all kinds of stalking, just to get in with him, because we realized we'd spoken to so many other people along the way, and he was probably the first senior male Indian guy that we chatted to, and he looked at us and he just went, I don't have space for you, and I like you, and I see that there's potential here, and yes, if we get a chance, I can make it work. And we basically just hounded him. I think he recognized that he had a role to play in, you know, giving us a hand up and giving me a hand up, and we basically followed him until he basically succumbed. And it was basically the start of our career together. That was Mandy and I working together for the first time, and it comes down to just realizing that this human being recognized something in us, and we saw that opportunity to become that person.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. You're making me think of, because we're talking about advertising, and it was difficult, and it still is to this day. Imagine the world of classical music. you know, places like the Royal Academy in the UK, there's a lady over there who's just so inspiring, Chi Chi Nwankwo. I don't know if you know her. She is a half Irish, half Nigerian lady who had a Nigerian dad and an Irish mum, and grew up in Berkshire in the UK, and just was just really good at music, really good at classical music, very, very clearly black because of her dad's heritage, but just got into classical music, did really well, went to the Royal Academy, and just became this absolute gun of classical music, and just didn't leave it there. But she recently, a couple of years ago, set up this classical music orchestra for black, Asian, ethnic minority kids. And the reason that sort of inspires me so much is you just think the world of classical music must be so intimidating and so alien for some of those black kids and Asian kids and so on. But to see someone like that, like the guy you talked about, the CD that you talked about, that is there, that is doing it, that's killing it, is doing really well, would just make you feel like, I can do that, and she's going to help me do
it's
it like the CD.
Right? Yeah, it's no longer in the realm of, well, we're just hit and hope. It's, oh, there's actually a pathway, yeah. There's a way to achieve this. I think that's the goal, right?
It's important.
To give people an opportunity to hope.
That was fascinating when you talked about advertising as being problem-solving at its heart, the core of it being problem-solving, because I love, as much as I love the craft of advertising, I'm a writer at heart, and I like the craft of writing, but I'm not one of those creative that will sit there and like craft typefaces and designs for, you know, for hours on end. I enjoy the problem solving bit of it a little bit more. I just wanted to get onto that a bit and talk to you about that a bit in the context of the Stop the Horror work that you guys did this year or last year?
Last year,
and obviously had awesome success this year. I'd love to get you to talk about how you went about coming up with that idea.
On 14 September 2017, we released a horror film by the famous Australian director Justin Kurzel. It was called Stop the Horror. The six-minute film was based on the true story of the last days of a terminally ill patient. The film was so distressing that a Stop the Horror button was included on screen. For most Australians, this film was too much to watch. The average viewer only lasted 3 minutes and 16 seconds before clicking the Stop the Horror button. They were then taken to a landing page where they were given the opportunity to really stop the horror. We explained that Victorian politicians were about to vote on a voluntary assisted dying bill, and we encouraged people to donate and write to their local politicians so they could help prevent the gruesome suffering of other terminally ill patients.
Basically, so we'd worked with Andrew Denton in South Australia the year before, and we'd come very close to convincing the South Australian government to basically pass the law. It ended up being, I think it was 26 votes to 26, and the Speaker of the House, after 8 hours of debate, said, no, it's not going to happen. And so the following year, Andrew came back to us, Andrew Denton came back to us, and asked us if we'd be interested in working on the Victorian campaign, because he knew that there was going to be a new bill introduced into Parliament. And of course, you know, it was something that we all believed in the agency, and had decided ages ago that we were gonna back, and we were gonna try and make this thing work, because it just makes sense. I think we all had personal stories that we felt were, you know, would have been different or could have been different had the world been a different place and had the laws been a different thing. And so we were all passionately involved in this idea from the, you know, in working on this project from the moment go. Anyway, he came up to us and he told us about this new brief that was this new plan to get the law introduced into Parliament. And we went away. He's got this book called The Damage Done, and Mandy and I got a copy from him, and we started reading these stories from, and basically it's 70 something stories told from the perspective of either terminally ill patients, their families, or people who've been medical staff. And it was just the worst possible read ever. It's just like the stories in there that are just horrific. While we were speaking about it, Mandy and I started talking about, you know, because at the same time there's the opposition, and it's largely the church as the opposition, and there's a lot of guilt and sort of, what's the word? There's a lot of guilt associated with voluntary assisted dying. It's used as a tool by the church to basically make people feel, and it's, some of it's just outright lying. And we realized that, you know, as we were talking, that, you know, a lot of the arguments used against voluntary assisted dying were just so emotionally charged that they presented the idea of killing a person in the worst possible light. And yet when we read the stories, it was filled with so much terror and violence in that surely that was worse. Surely watching a person go through that was easier than just taking their life. And so we came up with the idea that, you know, what if we could give people a show to watch, something to watch that made them want to stop and made them want to turn away. And when they turn away, that's when we tell them, well, they couldn't do that. Those people couldn't do that. They had to sit through this existence because we don't have a law in place. And so the idea was born from reading all those stories. And in fact, the story that we eventually went with is from Go Gentle. It's the story of Greg Sims and his life towards the end of his life. And it's told through the perspective of Nia Sims, his daughter, this man's life. And from a factual point of view, it was 100% correct. That was, you know, it was from a timeline perspective, that's the timeline. From an experience point of view, that's what he experienced. And each stage of our approval process included Nia Sims, who wrote the story. So, in fact, there's an interesting anecdote. We shot a scene. It's in the edit, in the final edit. It's about 2 minutes into the film, where the actor who played Greg Sims was writhing in pain, and he gets so. One of the parts of the story was that that Greg actually got so upset and so worked up with pain that he bashed his knee against the edge of the bed repeatedly until he started to bleed. Right? It was just such. He was in so much pain, and so in the performance of this. The actress who was playing Nia Sims got really worked up, and you know, once the scene had calmed down and he was calm, she sort of walked out, but she was so shaken up by the performance that she, and the camera was still following her, and she ended up throwing up off set because she was just worked up. Wow. And we actually, that made the cut, so we went, well, I mean, we've got it, like, that's an interesting, it's an interesting visceral moment, and it shows how this thing affects not just the person but the people around that person. And she refused to approve it. She said, no, that didn't happen, so we can't put that in. You know, it's that level of truth,
integrity
that was, and I think it was important. We tried to use our creative, you know, you know, smarts to try and explain to her why it was valuable, but in the end I think it was right to do that. I think
it's better that you left it out. Yeah,
that's right. I think it made right sense. It was truer to the story. It was the way it had to be.
That law actually got changed, didn't it? So I wondered how you actually felt, how you and Mandy actually felt when that law got changed, and you knew that piece of work had obviously had an impact on that,
you know,
thing changing.
I get goosebumps when I think about it, because we worked really hard on that project, and we really loved the project. But we'd worked really hard in the year before, and we'd really loved the project before, and we thought we were going to make a difference the year before, and we just came close, but we didn't make it. And the thing about, you know, often with campaigns, you can get satisfaction in the numbers. You can get satisfaction in lots of different metrics. When the only number is the number in the vote, it's very hard if you don't win, because it doesn't matter how many eyes saw it, how many people saw it, signed a petition, and did something. You know, it comes down to whether the law changed or not, and if it doesn't change, then it doesn't change. And so when the law changed, there was an immense sense of relief, and it's I've described it before as that post-exam feeling. You know, when you've just finished an exam and you feel hollow and you feel slightly exhausted and you sort of don't know what to do with yourself. It felt a bit like that. You know, you feel like okay, surely I have to do something else, and surely I have to make some other change or do something, because you're just stuck with it for so many months.
I would have gone down the pub and got pissed.
Well, we ended up cracking open a few bottles of champagne and just got hammered at the office. But yeah,
it's funny that you say that the one before where the law didn't change, that you felt like you'd been unsuccessful. I don't know, maybe many years ago I would have agreed with that. I don't agree with that today. I'll tell you why. I'll give you an example. One of my heroes is a guy called Arthur Scargill. He was a union leader in the miners' union in the UK during the miners' strike in the 80s, and that was a long and brutal strike, a long and brutal battle between the Conservatives and Margaret Thatcher, the PM of the time, and the miners, and they got pretty much starved back to work, and that industry got decimated by the Thatcher years. People would say to Arthur Scargill, you know, you lost, you did all of that for nothing, what a waste of time. And he used to say, no, we were victorious. The struggle itself was the victory. I think a lot of us in advertising like to think that what we do is really important, and a lot of it sort of isn't. And I like to think that I'm getting up out of bed in the morning and spending my life doing things that help people or enrich their lives or entertain them or add some value. But the truth is that a lot of the time we are flogging sports shoes or selling mobile phone data packs or whatever it may be, things that, you know, don't really, at the end of the day, maybe they help the economy like you said before, but, you know, really? Whereas this is a piece of work that genuinely changed the law that will just have such an amazing positive impact on people's lives. That just such an epic achievement.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a funny one, right? Because you've got to apply the same sort of energy and enthusiasm.
You do, to the mobile phone data pack.
To the mobile phone data pack. And it definitely is harder. I think when you realize that you are affecting lives and you're changing lives, that you bear some of that burden with you. But the truth is, you know, we've got a responsibility to do it for everyone. I think it's just easier to do it when there's such big things at stake. I go back to the South Australia not cracking it. I agree that the fight is important, but then I agree that that probably had an impact on the Victorian result. But it's an absolute result, whereas a lot of what we do on a weekly and daily basis and a monthly basis, it's a moving, progressive, slow build. We don't see these massive spikes in
brand affinity scores slowly, gently creeping upwards.
That's right, and I think it's that's part of the reason why work like, you know, the Palau Pledge, the work like Project Revoice, I think that's why they sort of resonate with people, because you see an immediate benefit and you see this thing galvanize people and change people, because it means more to everyone that it happens. It doesn't mean more to everyone when you sell a $5 impact, you know, and that's the challenge, right? Because when the moment that the stakes are higher and the moment that the value is higher, more people are interested and more people care, and it's tapping into that. That's, I suppose, the hard bit and trying to wrangle a creative idea that actually does resonate. That's the hard bit.
I mean, I sometimes think about it when you're busy working on the $5 impact brief or whatever it may be. Another one of my heroes, the boss, Bruce Springsteen, said about performing. He says that you've got to somehow hold in your mind the idea that this is the most important thing in the world and this actually doesn't mean anything at all, which are two totally conflicting things. And I just kind of feel that about, you know, when you're trying to encourage your team to keep going and have another crack at the Simpac banner ads, you know, how do you kind of get people to think this is actually...
You know what, the thing that I love most about what I do is that I like the making. I like the conceptual part of it, but then I like making. I feel like a lot of our creative process is spent selling. You know, we pitch an idea and then we hold onto it and we try and protect it for a very, very long period of time. And the thing that I like about what we do is actually to have it then, you know, it's why I like cooking, is because you can get home, you can start it and you can finish it and you can eat it, and there's a product and that's the reward in that. And so for me, the way I look at what we do is you find the value in that making, because I mean that's why we've spent four months trying to get the thing sold.
Well, it just made me sort of imagine working in a bank or for an insurance company where you would spend a lifetime doing whatever and you would never really see anything tangible. What kind of work is out there in the industry that really excites you at the moment? The sort of stuff that you think, God, I wish I'd done that.
I really love Project Revoice as a piece of work, and I think I love it because it's I've spoken to Ash about this piece of work. So, when he mentioned it, I was like, "Oh, this is golden." And it's quite a personal story that I can associate with it. My dad, towards the end of his life, he couldn't speak. He's lost the ability to speak because he had to have a tracheostomy. And so I understood that the relationship with your voice is actually such an important thing, and it's such a powerful thing. And when it's gone, it's a very difficult thing to deal with. And yet, at the base of this idea is like this mechanical, technological thing. It's got a technological heart, but yet it's full of empathy and full of humanity, and it uses technology that exists. I think for me, that one of the nicest things about this project is, you know, as an industry, we're always trying to come up with like a new thing and develop a new piece of tech. They took an existing piece of tech and they reshaped it and reinvented it and molded it into something that has meaning and has purpose. And for me, that's quite an interesting way of approaching a problem, and it's quite an interesting solution to the problem. And so it's probably one of my favorite pieces of work at the moment. The other piece that of work that's it's hard to pass up is the Nike work, you know, the Colin Kaepernick stuff. I think it's, you know, but that's not from, it's such a traditional campaign, actually. It's you know, it's just a strong idea and really articulated. But for me, the reason I like it is because it's just, that's the bravest thing a client can do. You know, you've got to, so much of our work is researched to within an inch of its life. You know, we try and take off all the sharp edges and we make it mean everything to everyone. And here you've got one of the biggest brands in the world taking a stance and making a statement. And I think that's incredible. And it's the only way you stay relevant. I think if you can't engage in a cultural debate and you can't have an opinion, then I think you lose relevance in this industry, and you do lose relevance in the market with your audience, because, you know, it's brands are not other; they are part of the culture, they are part of our environment. And unfortunately, if you're part of the culture and you're part of the environment, you have to have a conversation. You actually have to be engaged in conversation.
That's why I'd say I'd agree with all of that, except for one thing we mentioned, that it was such a brave thing to do. I kind of feel because of what you went on to say, that it's almost the thing that you must do. You must be relevant.
That's
you
right.
must be part of that conversation. It's actually braver or stupider or whatever the word is to just not be part of a conversation, because then you're just talking about your products. You're just kind of up on a, you know, ivory tower, just telling people, you know, shouting at people.
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that when you can be part of a conversation, part of a conversation about things that people care about? We've covered a lot of different areas. We've covered some really interesting stuff. So your background, your upbringing in South Africa, apartheid, all of those things, a life in creativity, some amazing work. Has that, I know it's obviously impossible to boil that all down into a pithy little Oscar Wildean epigram, but is there one lesson that you've gleaned from all of that experience that you would leave us with?
I think the lesson that I'd leave people with is, don't be over familiar the first time you meet someone. I think that over-familiarity is a dangerous thing in an initial meeting with a person, because it stops you from listening. And I think it's better to listen and to be friendly and to be engaged, but to have them a distance of respect, because that's how you take in more from the other person. Mm. And the moment you can take in more from the other person, then you can probably contribute more as well.
Mm. What's the difference between friendliness and over-familiarity? That's probably quite a grey area, is it?
Not really. I think that I think often when people meet for the I've had a few people that I've met for the first time who work in an industry full of big personalities, right? I'm an introvert by nature. I'm not a good extrovert. I have to practice to be an extrovert. And what I've noticed is there's a difference between friendliness and being engaged and engaging with a person, and then it tips over into not stopping and not listening and not paying attention to what other people are saying. And I think it boils down to familiarity, because I think when you feel too comfortable with a person, it changes the way you behave with them. And I think that's a thing that I've noticed with especially extroverted people, that I think is an undoing, because there's lots of other voices that can be heard. And It's not about being less friendly. It's about creating space to hear.
Mm. Sounds like it's also about empathy, maybe having the ability to let empathy happen.
Yeah, as an introvert, it's a it's a tough one because I'm very quick to like, oh, okay, just go find the corner, find the nearest corner and look and watch from the corner. But yes, it is about empathy and recognizing that, you know, I had a friend who was a bit like me. He takes really a long time to make his point. He would pause for very long between his bits. And the first time I introduced him to another friend of mine, the other friend couldn't wait. He couldn't wait for him to just get his point across. And so he just jumped over straight over the top of him. And I've paid attention to that over the years. A lot of people do that. We don't give people space. And I think in the first meeting, in the first time you meet someone, it's the time to stop and listen.
Thanks, Avish. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thanks again to Avish. Hey, hey, hey. Thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Weston for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound. From creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts. They're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again, until next time.